When the patient is so sick, it makes you want to poop your pants. You need some critical care insights from the fast-talking, quick-thinking Mr. New York and MCRIT podcast guru, Dr. Scott Weingart. It's time for...
Critical Care Mailbag.
Now look out, because he's going to bust some knowledge right into your head.
Scott Weingart!
You've got yourself a patient who has isolated head trauma, as we say. They've got a brain bleed, like an intraparenchymal bleed. They're not going to need to go to surgery immediately. It's not, they don't have, you know, not herniating. Blood pressure is 90 systolic. They're intubated. What is your post-intubation plan? Do you want to get them on propofol at some point? Is there an actual advantage to propofol beyond seizure control? Say this patient was started on fentanyl, a fentanyl bolus and drip. The neurosurgeon wants them to be on propofol so that they can get them, you know, weaned off easily and start doing neuro checks and see, you know, how responsive they are.
Yeah, well, there's so much in this case that bears talking about. The first thing, like before we even get to a post-intubation plan, is I would be really, really scared about why this patient's hypotensive. You told me it's an isolated head trauma. They should be hypertensive. The brain and your neurovascular system is really, in most cases, trying hard to increase perfusion unsuccessfully, and they'll just keep cranking up the blood pressure through your sympathetics to try to get blood flow to areas that just can't because they're damaged. So oftentimes you're dealing with intractable hypertension. So hypotensive makes me very leery about what's going on right now.
And what is your worry? Would your worry be neurogenic shock?
You don't get to the point of neurogenic shock or hypotension from brain swelling really until the point of herniation on your brainstem structures.
I'm thinking like they hit their head and maybe there's a cord injury that you're not aware of because, you know, they got pan scanned from head to pelvis and you just don't see it.
It would be tough for me to believe that you had neurogenic shock with no bony evidence. It's possible, but it wouldn't be my first thought. Did the patient get mannitol? Because this is classic. People give mannitol and they don't seem to understand that it's a potent diuretic. And then the patient pees out their entire plasma volume. And people are not understanding that to use this drug, you have to match the patient's urine output. You need to give as much normal saline as they pee out if you want them not to become hypotensive.
Let's take that out of the picture. There's no mannitol given. They were intubated with etomidate and 1.2 mg per kg of rocuronium.
See, so I was about to say, like the second thing on the differential is, did this patient get a overzealous sedation package for their intubation? Now, the ones you just named, it shouldn't do it in an isolated head trauma, so that's off the list. But on the other hand, if they gave, you know, 250 of propofol with some fentanyl because they were worried about ICP and some lido because they were worried about ICP, I certainly have seen those patients get hypotensive. But you've taken that away from me, Rob. So now I'm still scared. Now, we see this very commonly in aneurysmal subarachnoids. Well, not very commonly, but if you're in a tertiary referral center, you see it commonly. The neurocardiogenic axis effects of a brain bleed like an aneurysmal subarachnoid. Now, this has been reported for other bleeds, trauma bleeds or intraparenchymal bleeds, and they could actually get cardiogenic shock, sometimes of the Takotsubo variant and sometimes of other variants, directly from their brain injury. And so the first thing I'd be doing on this patient with a low blood pressure is starting up norepinephrine without any other move before I got their blood pressure well suited to where I want, because
not just a liter of saline bolus.
Hell no. I am not going to leave this patient for the 15 to 20 minutes it's going to take for you to get a liter of saline in. And if you're thinking it's faster than that, you're kidding yourself. I am not going to leave them hypotensive. We know hypotension and malperfusion, especially in the first, you know, 24 hours, because they are not auto-regulating their brain perfusion well, is incredibly deleterious. So much to the point where you may be adversely affecting your patient's mortality for every period of time you leave them hypotensive. So hells no. In fact, if the nurses have to mix up the norepi, I'm going to be giving them push-dose epinephrine the second I see a low blood pressure.
And what is it that's scaring you so much about that 90 systolic? And I want to take other trauma out of it. You know, aorta looks fine. There's no pericardial effusion. The lungs look fine. The belly's fine. The pelvis is not fractured. There's no hemorrhage. There's no herniation. There's no midline shift.
The areas of the brain that we could potentially save are at risk with that hypotension. And we can't leave them there. And then the other thing that's scaring me is it's not in keeping with the way this clinical scenario is supposed to progress. They're not supposed to be hypotensive. So either I'm missing something, in fact, I probably am missing something, or I myself have caused this hypotension. So not only am I screwing the patient by not fixing it, but I probably caused it in the first place.
The hypotensive brain bleed makes Scott nervous, and I think it should make the rest of us nervous too. The things you have to consider are, one, is there a source of bleeding you missed, like the belly or chest or a long bone fracture? Number two, is the patient herniating? Number three, did they get a medication that caused this, something like mannitol for presumed increased ICP or your induction agent? Number four, neurogenic shock from a spinal injury? And number five, stress cardiomyopathy or Takotsubo's cardiomyopathy? The key here is going to be supporting their blood pressure immediately, either with a norepinephrine drip or push-dose epinephrine, because episodes of hypotension are killers in severe brain injury. Once you're working on getting that BP up, start searching for a cause.
In a patient you don't know their baseline blood pressure, you know, say they're 40 years old, what would be your goal? Now, we're talking about for cerebral perfusion.
So, and this is all guesstimate until they have an ICP monitor in. And even then, this is all, you know, kind of murky science. We don't really know the answers to this. But in general, a MAP of 80 would be the bare minimum. What that does is, if you assume that their ICP is hovering around 20, it gives you a nice buffer to continue a cerebral perfusion pressure of 55 to 60.
And while you're giving your push-dose pressors, I want to get to this on the granular level, and you're getting your norepi ready, are you also giving them fluid to kind of fill up their tank?
Yeah, I got no problem giving this patient fluid. If you have it available, a much cleverer move, because it's going to really kill two birds with one stone, is to give hypertonic saline. And that could be 3% sodium chloride, or in more likely in most EDs, because the medical safety people have clamped down on your ability to easily access this stuff. You have to call from it from the pharmacy as opposed to having it readily available. You might want to consider giving the patient 1 to 2 amps of sodium bicarb, which is 7% hypertonic saline, and will give you both an ICP decrease, therefore leaving them, even though hypotensive, making better cerebral perfusion, and also a potent increase in their cardiac output. Now, you don't want to slam it in. You want to give it over about 5 minutes for each amp, but that will very nicely give you a hit of cardiac output to increase blood pressure.
In all this discussion on causes and treatment of the hypotensive brain bleed, we lost track of the original question Rob had for Scott regarding post-intubation care.
Do you prefer propofol over fentanyl, or would you prefer fentanyl over propofol in this situation at that blood pressure?
Okay, so we got a few things to talk about with that. And really, we're getting into the sedation of a neurocritically ill patient. It's easy. We, in general, prefer short-acting agents to give an exam, but it's really not the most crucial part of it, because most of these patients, if they're already intubated, need ICP monitors. They have a CT scan. If there's any change in their status, they should get another CT scan. Honestly, the exam is not all that important once they're intubated. Now, keeping a patient with a good exam before intubation is incredibly important, because it's going to be the difference between them getting a big bolt in their head or not. But honestly, exam preservation, even though the neurosurgeons will bitch and moan about it, it's important, but it's not the primary importance. More important is using sedative agents that bring something good to the party, which means that in addition to sedating the patient for their intubation, they're decreasing the cerebral metabolic rate and therefore decreasing the oxygen requirements of the brain and therefore decreasing ICP. So that's why I'd actually, in this patient, prefer an agent like propofol for all the reasons we discussed. It's eminently titratable and it decreases the cerebral metabolic rate. And the seizures, yeah, maybe, but I've already treated the patient as seizure prophylaxis and I could certainly treat them if they have a seizure. So that's not it.
Brushing beyond that. If you have a patient who's got head trauma, are you doing immediate seizure prophylaxis on them? I mean, if you like identify something bad, what are you using?
So it's levetiracetam, or Keppra is the generic, much easier to say name for us. We've moved away from the phenytoin or phosphenytoin drugs. There's some suggestion in TBI that it may have worse cognitive outcomes. I'm not sure if that's true, but Keppra is so much easier to dose. It doesn't require leveling. And so in general, that's what we're doing. And I think many trauma centers have moved to that as well.
I am not doing that. Is there evidence that that decreases the rate of subsequent seizure, at least in the acute period?
Okay, it's all about the acute. We have no ability, and nor should they be on long-term seizure prophylaxis. It's really short-term. It's 7 days, and then it gets stopped. It should be an automatic stop. You do not want them on long-term anti-epileptic drugs. But in general, I think that's the current set of recommendations for almost every neurotrauma or neurocritical care unit that I've dealt with.
One thing to make clear here on the recommendation for seizure prophylaxis is that this applies to traumatic intracranial hemorrhage, not to spontaneous or aneurysmal bleeds. In those patients, it appears that seizure prophylaxis doesn't have any benefit and may confirm a harm. So in general, the recommendation in non-traumatic bleeds is to not prophylax.
Your choice would be propofol, and your choice would be propofol even over an agent that would be less likely to cause hypotension. And you're going to be controlling that blood pressure with fluid and with vasopressors.
And probably predominantly with vasopressors. I have zero barrier to starting any patient on vasopressors if the reason I'm doing it is I feel the vasodilatory effects of the sedative agent I want them on is the reason I might avoid that sedative agent. So if I want them on propofol and I'm like, well, it might vasodilate them, so I don't know if I could use it. Well, then let's just eliminate vasodilation as being a problem by putting them on a vasoconstrictor. This is not to say, like, take an exsanguinating patient, use propofol and norepi. That's just stupid. But what we're saying in this patient is that they are not actively exsanguinating. They are not profoundly dehydrated from some other pre-brain injury problem. Yeah, and that patient, absolutely. Put them on norepi, dial in the map where you want, and start them on propofol.
When you start that patient on propofol, regardless of the blood pressure, are you doing a bolus and then a drip? And if you are, what is your dose for your bolus post-intubation and your drip dose?
This is when I might want to recommend something different than the actual practice you may observe me performing. And this is how it's supposed to be, because if you ask an airline pilot the perfect, you know, landing procedure, they'll give you a perfect list, and then you look at them and they're doing something entirely different. What I would recommend is not using pushes of propofol. There's huge swings in blood pressure that come up with that, and you're much better because it's such a rapid acting agent of just titrating up and down. But sometimes you just want to get them where you want. But I would advise small boluses. Like, give them 2 cc's, 20 milligrams at a time, and see what it does, as opposed to giving them 10, because you can't take it back for a while. You're much better off at starting them at like 20 or 30 micrograms per kilogram per minute and just titrating up.
A lot of post-intubation protocols are going to have the bolus at 0.5 mg per kg, so kind of half of the procedural sedation dose, and then 15 micrograms per kilogram per minute. But you would maybe start the drip a little higher, start the infusion a little higher, and forego the bolus.
Yeah, I probably would. With the understanding, and this is really emphasized at Essentials, and I emphasize it all the time, it's really the practical understanding of emergency medicine. If you start a drip without a bolus, and there's a huge dead space in your IV line, you might not be seeing those effects for a while. So in general, even if I'm just starting a drip and not bolusing, I will bolus the bare minimum to make that white go to the patient's IV. So if I'm piggybacking that propofol in somewhere, I'll draw up 2 or 3 cc's and push just enough to make sure it's actually touching the patient's bloodstream.
Isolated head trauma can seem simple, but there's a lot of nuance here. If the patient has a low BP, reverse that immediately with a norepinephrine infusion or push-dose epinephrine to avoid the morbidity and mortality we know accompanies hypotension in these patients. Think about why that BP is low. Did you miss another injury causing hemorrhagic shock? Is the patient herniating? Did your medical treatment do it with mannitol or induction agents? Or does the patient have a stress cardiomyopathy? And finally, for sedation, propofol appears to be the way to go here, but the key, as always, is to start low and go slow. Consider just initiating the drip, as the bolus can cause wide swings in blood pressure, but make sure that there isn't a bunch of IV dead space between the infusion and the patient, or the patient's going to be naked from sedation for too long.
Absolutely.